Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview today is with Crystal Earle. You are going to really enjoy this interview on a whole lot of levels. Crystal and I have known each other a long time. We met a few years ago at a youth leadership event, I believe, in Niagara Falls, and we've been talking about something like this for quite some time, and her mission is to help you change your story. And so we're going to talk about how she, at some point in her life, she had to decide what she had to believe. We're going to talk about new opportunities, and we're going to talk about how we're kind of shamed into asking, you know, new questions. And we're going to talk a little bit about her. She talks about her strongest currency. I love this. Her strongest currency being her ability to create social change. And we're going to talk about why, you know, and how love wins all the time. Check her out online. You're going to, the bio is there. The links are there. Her book Resonate. And don't forget to go to davidpecklive.com. My book is there, along with about 150 other interviews. But for now, focus in on Crystal and listen up.
Well, welcome to Face to Face, and we are joined by another very special guest today. Crystal Earle is here today. Your Brilliance Unlimited. I think it's yourbrillianceunlimited.com. I'm sure we're going to get back to that in a minute. Crystal's a speaker. She's a writer. We've worked together in a few events. We're going to find out a little bit more about her, but let's first get to thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming today, Crystal.
Thank you, David. I'm so excited to be here.
It makes it sound like we're actually face-to-face, like we're actually in the same room together, but we're so not. It's just it's such a lie. My podcast is just one big lie, Crystal. It's called Face-to-Face, and I rarely see anybody that I interview face-to-face. So it's,
well, I should have popped a picture of you up on my screen.
That's right.
At least I felt like I was talking.
Yeah, at least in Skype, you get like some sort of cryptic photo of somebody.
Exactly.
Or maybe a blurry image. So you've written a book called Resonate. We're going to talk about that, I'm sure. Learn to love your story is the quote on your Twitter page. What the heck? So you're a social entrepreneur, clearly, but tell me more about what you do.
Well, currently, right now, I am a, it's such a funny thing, right? Because it's like you want to have that little handy-dandy little elevator pitch.
Yes. But I don't believe in elevator pitches, by the way. I think they're lies.
It's so difficult. Through my work with Your Brilliance Unlimited, I consult and coach. I work with clients with nonprofits and some different organizations and individuals around changing the stories that they're telling themselves and the world. And that comes also through, I'm a professional speaker and have trained a lot of speakers over the years. And then I'm a writer, and so I create a lot of content and have some community online. And my book, Resonate, came out at the end of 2014, and it's about how we can change the stories that we tell ourselves about what's possible for us to create in the world.
So do you mean change, when you say change the story, do you mean the way we think about ourselves and then therefore go on to do great things? Or do you mean about sort of just the way we, I guess the way we see the world, and maybe they're both intimately connected, I'm not sure.
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, stories are a funny thing because we are surrounded by them all the time, right? Like, you know, for example, if I was to say, if we were face to face, David, I would say, you know, I say, well, you know, I'll give you one word. I'll give you the word father. And immediately, neither you, like you nor I nor anyone is ever going to have the same thing that comes to mind when they hear the word father, because we all have a different experience. We all have a different story around the word father based on our experience. A story that we tell ourselves of what a father is. You know, I have a fabulous dad. So my stories around my dad are, you know, they revolve around feeling protected and different things. But for someone else, they could be very different stories. And so the stories we tell ourselves about, you know, Seth Godin says we're always telling stories, right? But the most powerful stories are the ones that we tell ourselves. And those are the ones that we are the only people that decide what the stories are going to be. And when we go, as we go through things in our lives, inevitably we come upon experiences and we decide what we're going to believe about those experiences, because the experience in and of themselves is truthfully just a neutral thing. It just happens, but we decide the importance we're going to assign to it.
So is there, I mean, while you're chatting, I'm thinking cognitive based therapy. Is there, is there a connection in a way to this idea? Cause I know that CBT, and I've done some myself, is kind of about, it's not changing your story, but I guess it kind of is in a sense, because we all have our story. It's just, I think CBT says, David, you're having a tough time really getting to the real story. You've told yourself a bunch of these lies. Like, as you were talking about this notion of father, right? If we come out of an abusive relationship, well, that's, we're going to have a horrible idea of what it means to be a father, or what a father is, or what a dad means, and so on. So is that what you're really trying to, like, is there sort of a therapeutic aspect to this as well?
I mean,
there's a couple of questions in there.
Sure. I think there is. And I, by no means am I, I'm a licensed coach, but I'm not a therapist.
Right.
But I do, so I do some cognitive-based coaching with clients, yes. But, you know, it's more, when I see changing our story, it's more like the idea of, we can't change the past, obviously. The future is yet to be determined, but we can act into what we want our story to be about. So, you know, changing our story is literally about this, about transitioning and transforming it into what we want it to become, you know, because we are, for example, there was some really great studies. There's a really awesome book that I highly recommend called Redirect. It's by Timothy Wilson, I think is his name.
Yeah, Redirect.
In this book, and this is the perfect example, and I was so excited when I read this book, because it had been it was scientific-based evidence for what I have been working on for a long time. He talked about, for example, one of the things that they used with over a series of years of trying to help young women at risk that were marginalized from marginalized maybe families and neighborhoods, to help them prevent teenage pregnancy, if to not become a statistic of something and of their experience. Now, those girls are often in those situations. They are coming from backgrounds of there's not a lot to aspire to. They're held back in a lot of ways. Maybe they have had no experience previous to becoming a teenager about understanding the value of who they are. There's a whole bunch of stuff around that. And what they found was when they were that there's a lot of programs that have been in place for a long time, everything from the, you know, kind of scare the hell out of you about, like, this is what's going to happen if you become a teenager, or if you become a teenage parent and you're not ready for it, you know, all these different ways about pregnancy prevention. But what they found was the most long-term amazing results with these young girls was having them experience two things in particular: having a mentor, someone in their lives that was patterning, helping them pattern what they wanted their life to look like. And amazingly and surprisingly, getting them involved in, really linked into a volunteer program in the community that gave them ownership in it and helped them to begin to to realize that they didn't have to become a product of where they'd come from. So it was literally like shifting. So yeah, it is like cognitive behavioral therapy, right? But it was literally helping them shift how they saw what was possible for them to create. And there's that beautiful tipping point that we all have the power to create in our lives. And it's not a one-off thing, right? It's incremental change. And you and I, in a previous conversation, were talking about how we make incremental change in our lives all the time. And changing and transforming your story is about recognizing that there's something more than what you believe to be possible, but giving yourself the grace to realize and journey into what it can be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I have so many places I want to go. I mean, I'm thinking modern existentialism here. I'm thinking you're way too positive for my liking, Crystal. like, okay, you've read The Secret one too many times, you know?
Funny.
Yeah, but I don't think that's true, right? Because I think you and I have worked at a couple of events over the years, and I don't know you really well, but I feel like there's a dose of reality to this that might be not a part of a lot of, you know, the power of positive thinking kind of stuff, the whole Anthony Robbins-like appeal and the secret appeal.
Like,
you know what I mean?
Totally. Like, and I mean, I'm definitely a glasses half full person by nature.
Right. Yeah. You know what Woody Allen says, right? And I'm sure I've said this before, but the glass is half full of poison. That's what Woody Allen says. Yeah.
Woody Allen would say that.
That's right.
so let me just give you a little background on my experience and how it all kind of played out in a few ways for me. Just to, if you want, do you want me to share?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah, go. Yeah, good. Okay. Well, I mean, we're talking about story, right? Let's hear a bit of yours.
So 7 years ago, I was co-founder of a charity. It's called Live Different. It's based out of Hamilton, doing really great things. But one of the big parts of what we did and what I created in Live Different was a social humanitarian program where youth and young adults, and now there's a lot of variety of groups, work in developing countries in communities, partnering with communities to build schools and houses and children's homes. And by no means did we ever think we were saving the world, but it was about building significant relationships both ways that were beneficial for both sides of the equation. And in 2009, I stumbled into an adoption. A little girl that I knew from a community, and I wasn't a parent at that point, she was orphaned, and she was from a community that I was working with the people there that were largely stateless Haitian people working at a garbage dump. And so this began this journey where my husband and I were ready to, we were going to adopt this girl, and we were going to have, it was going to be a quick adoption turnaround. We were going to get an emergency visa, and we'd started everything, started the process, and the Ontario government stepped in and said, no, you need to do an adoption the right way. So, okay, we started doing everything with the home studies. And in 2010, I was on a quick tour in Denmark, and I'm sitting in a Turkish shawarma place in Copenhagen, Denmark, eating shawarma. I know, so random. I was touring in a high school on a high school tour with a team, because that's what we were doing in Canada as well. And sitting in the shawarma place, you know how they always have TVs up in the corner of shawarma places?
Right.
And we're eating, and I can see on the screen that all this, like, destruction has just happened, and I can't read anything because it's all in Danish, except this one word at the bottom that said Haiti, and I was like, oh, my gosh. And so I ran back to where I was staying, and I called, and sure enough, the earthquake had happened. And so everything was propelled forward really quickly. So I went to Dominican because Widleen, my daughter, had been born in Dominican. And when I got to Dominican, I thought there was like all these airlines from over the world. We were fast tracking all these adoptions. We're partnering with countries, and we were in line to get this done. And so I thought I was going to be in Dominican Republic. This was in July and January of 2010. I thought I was going to be there for 2 weeks. Now my third day, and this little girl's 4 years old. I really don't know her because I didn't have custody of her until everything happened so quickly. She didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Creole, and she was in shock over everything that just happened in her life, and I was in shock over the fact that I just became a parent.
Right.
And 3 days into getting there, I went on actually the CBC News site and found out that there's a group of American people, quote-unquote missionaries, that got busted for trafficking children out of Haiti.
Wow. I remember yeah, the story.
Yeah. And the next morning, the UN shut down everything going in and out of Haiti for any adoptions. So then here I was now with this child that I didn't have full custody to, had, and every paper that we had was declared invalid. And then a few months later, the wheels just began to fall off. And within another year and a half, my husband and I actually split up. And so we were raising Woodlane together. But in the middle of all that, everything just is still unresolved to this day. I commute every 2 weeks. I live between Toronto and Dominican Republic. And in the middle of all that, when my life was completely in shambles and I didn't know what was up because I was so angry. I was like, I didn't know who to be. I was angry at God, at myself, whatever, right? Like, this was so not part of the plan. Like, has anybody noticed that I've given my life to, like, saving people and, like, the poor and all these things, you know? Like, you just feel so totally ripped off. And I had to decide what I was going to believe. That's really what it came down to. I had to decide because it wasn't just about the situation. It was calling into question everything that I believed about myself. You know, when you experience the death of a relationship that doesn't end the way you want, you question, you know, you have all those questions about, like, am I worth it? Am I worth loving? Am I, you know, and when other things happen, you question, am I good enough? Do I deserve this? Am I worth enough? And so when I talk about, when I talk to clients and to audiences and we work through, like, determining what your story is going to believe, what story you're going to believe about what's possible, it comes down often to the question of just questioning what you're willing to believe about who you are and where you came from, but, like, what's possible from this point forward. Because whether or not we recognize it, this moment is a fresh start. Like, you know, so your past is your past, but that the only person that decides how much weight that past is going to hold is us, right? Like every day is a new opportunity, but at the risk of sounding so airy-fairy about it, but it's true, right?
Yeah.
Because it really is, it's about a mindset and it's about what you're willing to set your mind on.
So lots of tragedy, lots of change, lots of upset. Why didn't you cocoon?
I did for a while.
Okay.
I did, which is so not my personality. That anybody that knows me, like, and even when I look back at pictures of myself, and I was like, I hardly recognize myself.
Wow.
'Cause you go through this state of shock when your world just, like, goes into shambles. You have this it's like a tumble. I don't know if you've ever been surfing, but like,
I have actually. Yeah.
If you've ever been tumbled in a wave, have you ever had that happen? And you come up and you're like, at first you're just glad you can breathe. And you or me, you got over the shock of, like, losing your bikini somewhere back in the ocean. And then you're like.
That's happened to me several times, leaving my bikini in the ocean.
It's a horrible feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you come up and you're just like, what just happened? And that was how I felt for a while. And you have moments where partly the grace for me was the fact that I had a child. And every day I just realized, man, I just have to put one foot in front of the other. And you rebuild slowly, step by step. And it's beautiful and painful and awesome and horrible all in one thing.
Yeah. So I don't want the simple solution, the pill or the injection that, you know, you took or you needed or whatever. But I mean, was it friends? Was it a community? Were there people that you were able to rely on? I mean, I work pretty much in a silo for the most part. I'm a consultant. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough. And then I get into a group of people and I forget how invigorating that is.
Yeah.
You know, being able to just sort of hang out and brainstorm and complain and commiserate and just be with others, I suppose, right? And so is that how you survived, would you say? Is that how you got through?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. There was a couple of key people in my life in particular that were, that had been my friends through the whole thing. And in respect to going through a divorce, my former husband and I are actually really, we have a great relationship. So that's not it. But having friends who, in that respect, were like, they loved you, but they loved you because of who you are, not what they not what they want you to become. And you know, I'm from a faith background, like a Christian faith background, and so my faith obviously played into a lot about my ultimate belief in good and mm-hmm. in the bigger picture. But within that, everything I believed was really put to the test. And on the other side, it's kind of like you go through this like wash and spin cycle and get tossed mm-hmm. out the dryer. And mm-hmm. you're like, I don't know. I began to realize that I had made assumptions about what I thought I deserved, what I,
right.
you know,
right.
you know, and crazy, you know, David, it's a crazy question. I remember being in the middle of this and, you know, here I am, I'm stranded in Dominican Republic, and anybody else would be like, whoa, tough thing. Like, woe mm-hmm. is you, right?
You're yeah. You're breaking my heart. Yep. Yeah. Go look for your bikini in the ocean, will you? Yeah.
Exactly. But this had become to it, had, you know, at the time it had represented like just so many of my dreams, and I was grieving. When your life takes a hard left and you know, like it's almost like you grieve what you never thought was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, like mm-hmm. when you experience a death, I lost my brother when he was 20, and grieving a death is you grieve what you had because you can remember, you know, there's all those memories and they were all good. Like my brother, you know, he's very much alive in my memory. But when you experience the death of a relationship and of a future you thought you were going to have, it's like you have to grieve letting go of a dream that you thought was yours to hold on to.
Right.
And it's almost like this entitlement you get around what you think your life should be. And I remember being in this Dominican village. I was still working with Live Different at the time, and we were working in this community. And there was this amazing woman, and I had gone to talk to her because we were getting ready to build a house with her in the community. And she was a Dominican woman who'd taken in four, she's a grandma. She had taken in four kids. They were all AIDS orphans, and none of them were even like her biological family. And two of them were Haitian, which is really unheard of in many communities in Dominican Republic. There's a lot of racial tension. And I just remember having this conversation with this woman, and you know when you have a conversation with someone and you're talking to them, but there's an entire conversation going on in the back of your mm-hmm. head at the same time. And I was having this conversation, and it was like this, it was about 6 months after the acid falling out of my life and realizing that as she's talking, it was just like this light just went on. And I had been saying for so long, I'd been asking myself the wrong question. I'd been asking, why me? And when we ask the wrong question, you know, and we always want to ask questions. I mean, questions are how we, you know, we're always seeking for answers. But I'd been asking all these questions that were causing you to pull in. Why me? What did I do?
Right.
And it was all finger pointing questions. And as that woman was talking, I thought, why not me? Why am I so scared of having to let go of what I thought my future should be? Like, I wonder what's possible if I could let go of this. And it began this whole quest for me where I feel like I began to just spiral up back out of things. And, you know, and asking questions is, oh man, it's such a powerful tool. I always think of questions like a way, you know, the questions that we ask are always going to create the direction of where we're thinking. You know, it's like, for example, when I took driver training, and I remember one of the things in my driver training was they were so adamant about at nighttime when you're driving and there's another car coming towards you, whatever you're focused on, you're going to drive towards. So don't look into the light. So that
yes.
car coming
yes.
towards you, right?
Yeah. Focus I remember on. That lesson too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like look to the, what is it? The white line on the right side
look
of the road.
Look to the bottom right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Follow
yeah. Yeah.
That. Follow
yeah. Yeah.
That.
Isn't that fascinating? That's one of the things that really stands out for my driver
yeah.
training too.
And that's a major life lesson, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Wherever you're focusing, you're going to start to drive your life towards, you're going to start to live into. And so when we keep on asking ourselves these questions about like, why me, what did I do? Well, we're focusing, we're looking over our shoulder, right? And you're looking over your shoulder. You can only shoulder check when you're driving. Like, if you know, like that's a dangerous place to be if you're trying to move forward by looking over your shoulder. And as like that's, you know, that is so true to our lives. And in that moment when I was standing in that community, and it sounds so melodramatic, but it really was that singular moment that I can point back to when it was like I actually began to change the quality of the questions that I was asking myself.
Hmm.
And it just began to change how I viewed everything.
How does So first of all, what is the question, right? If it wasn't why me, what was the question? And then, as if you can reduce it to one, but how do you ask better questions? I mean, I've often said you can tell a lot about a person by the nature of the questions they ask. Mm-hmm. I mean, philosophy is my background. It is about the question, right? It is about...
It totally is.
And yet I think a lot of philosophers, I actually think, have erred on the side of the solution. You know, they've tried to cram their philosophy into some sort of mathematical framework that says this is the way it is. And this is why I love what you're thinking. I mean, you are an existentialist. I mean, you are all about the future. You are all about possibility. You are all about decisions and about taking steps and moving forward and understand. But, and you know, that's Kierkegaard, right? Move forward, understand by looking backward. And so how do you ask better questions? How the hell do you ask better questions?
Oh, questions are such beautiful, beautiful things. You know, like I lost when you were talking. I was so lost. I was like, oh, I love Kierkegaard when you said that.
I invoke Kierkegaard whenever I can. Yes, I Kierkegaard, Pascal, and Plato. Those, you know.
Yeah. Well, okay. So here's something that I've come to discover when I've talked with people and been in coaching conversations and all kinds of stuff. You know, from the time that we are little, I don't know, because you and I think have both grown up in a Western culture and our education comes from that. And it's beautiful on the one hand, because from the time that we were little, probably in grade two, I think I remember story problems became the bane of my existence when I was a kid.
Which kind of problems?
Story problems, math story
problems.
Oh,
I hate those. I despise mathematics. Why do we need mathematics?
Why do we need them? But, you know, but there's this one line in story problems, solve the problem, solve the problem. And so from the time that we're little, it gives us the ability to obviously be strategic thinkers in terms of seeing something and seeing it as solvable. But everything, I think it causes us to almost create, what would you call it, like a dichotomy in our thinking where it's like everything is either has to become a problem to solve or it's a write-off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's like we become very black and white in our thinking, you know, like now there's a problem I got to solve. And and for me personally, first of all, I saw that in my life where everything became a problem that I needed to solve. And if I couldn't solve the problem, there was a panic that was rising in me because my whole belief in what was, you know, around who I was that I was able to solve problems and I was able to provide solutions for people. And coming to realize, so back to the idea of like, how do we ask better questions is that, you know, I began, one of the questions I asked myself was, I wonder who I would be without this worry, this stress, you know,
nice.
I wonder who I'd be without this. And you know what, who I'd be was really awesome without that, you know, and I began to see things as just even not being scared to ask questions that will lead to more questions. Like, why is it, where in my life did I think that questions without concrete answers were scary and too scary to ask, but somewhere in my education and upbringing and my whole, even, you know, dare I say, like even my religious background. But it's true, right?
It's not any one thing. I don't think. I think it's really, what's the word? It's a cumulative problem, right? I mean, I've great quote the other day. Some of the best. Hang on, let me see if I can get it. Some of the best pictures in the world were drawn with broken crayons.
Isn't that
awesome?
Yeah. So true.
But we're not taught that, right? You're taught as a kid that you got to draw within the lines and that you need the right color for the right piece of art and it needs to be a sharp crayon. Don't use a broken crayon, right?
So
use the broken ones to make candles, which is kind of a cool metaphor in its own right, I suppose. But at the same time, we're taught to color within the lines.
Totally.
Right? And it kind of it screws us over on a variety of levels. It really does.
It does. And there's something so beautiful about an inquisitive mind that we fashion our daily lives around not giving ourselves enough space to even ask that. You know, when kids are little, Warren Berger, I don't know if you've ever read the book, A More Beautiful Question. Oh, I love that book.
I don't think I have.
It's awesome. So he talks about how kids up until from the ages of basically, you know, when kids are what, like some kids talk really early, like 18 months or something, but basically from, you know, between the ages of like 2 and 5, kids can ask their questions, their parents' questions. And I think it's like up to 100 questions a day. And like a lot of parents would probably be like, if you have kids that age, you'd be like, are you kidding? It's got to be 5 times.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so there's this cumulative number of like, I don't know, something like 140,000 questions that kids will ask in those, in that basically 3-year time frame of their lives. But by the age of 5, the number of questions that children ask, according to the research, takes a crazy nosedive. It's a sharp, sharp, sharp decrease.
Interesting.
And interesting, right? So, and there's a few pretty solid theories that they have around why kids ask less questions. And obviously, that's when they start school. And they enter into an education system but there's a couple of reasons that they've put forward. And one is that between the ages of like 2 and 5, children are with a trusted adult, right? They spend their day around a trusted adult. So whether that's like a parent or a caretaker, that, you know, there's a high trust relationship there, mm-hmm. with that adult. And so there's no filter. There's no filter on how many questions they ask, because there's a freedom for them to be inquisitive.
Sure. Yep.
And there's no repercussions,
yep.
for the most part,
it's
for
good.
Asking questions.
It's good, because that's exactly what it is. You get your you essentially learn that you get your hand slapped for asking questions.
Well, totally.
And it happens in a variety of ways, right?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, like, you know, I've worked in education for a long time, but I haven't been a teacher. And especially not in a primary classroom, like that's a lot of pressure on an adult, right? You've got 20 little humans that are always going to be asking questions. So you naturally have to create an order.
Of course.
Things,
totally.
Right?
And, yep. Yep.
And so something that is created to, you know, it's a structure and a boundary put in place. But in a child's mind, that also makes asking questions becomes an unsafe thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you can easily feel shame from asking questions, or feel like it's not a smart question, or it's not a good enough question, or that question's already been answered. So I've already said that three times. I've already answered that 3 times today. So don't ask that again.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's none of those things are bad or evil intrinsically. It's just that they become part of the story that we build around everything. And so the ability to ask ourselves better questions, I think it can save us a lot of pain and take the pressure off of ourselves that, you know, maybe there isn't something to blame. Maybe crap just happens. And maybe I just need to be willing to see this, alter how I see this, and give myself grace and give the situation grace for what it can become rather than what I'm trying to make it be.
So you talk about your passion for, it sounds to me like these are my words, your passion for change, for social justice,
mm-hmm.
for innovative ways of turning the world upside down, I suppose, for children, for relationships. I mean, I hear a lot of that stuff. What would you say motivates you to do this kind of work?
Ultimately, it's about values, really, right? Because mm-hmm. I value conversations like what we're having right now. But I value.
Well, you said your line earlier was quote, I had to decide what I had to believe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I mean, clearly values based, right?
Yeah, and ultimately I just love. For me, my strongest currency is being able to create. I mean, I know this is. So in line with what you're talking about, but it's the ability to be able to create social change in some way.
Mm.
And I truly believe that, you know, change has to happen with what we believe about what's possible for us first. You know, mm-hmm. I can try and it can work for a while. I can, you know, go out into the world with all the best of intentions and I'm going to change the world. But unless I'm willing to change how I see myself, first of all, I'm not being the best version of myself possible. And so always, even in my work with Live Different, always it was started because I really believe, and every time I've talked in, you know, high schools, and I've talked to hundreds of thousands of students and university students and organizations, and it's always come back to the fact that we choose what we're going to believe about who we choose who we become.
Right.
And that's the only thing I can control. And so that to me is like what fuels me. If I can empower and offer the inspiration for people along the way and help them make, you know, tangible steps towards that, those decisions and to creating what that future is going to look like for them, then that to me is like, man, it's just the ultimate gift.
Do you think, so you're out speaking to a lot of young people, you started an organization dealing with young people. Are you, are you hopeful about where we're heading? I mean, in this Instagram like world, do you think that young people today feel like they are sort of the author of their future, that they do have this ability to drop the pebbles in the pond and watch, or is it more of a passive kind of, do you think, culture that's being created? And I guess what I'm talking about is the West mostly. I mean, we both traveled a lot in the global South, but mostly our worlds. I see our kids growing up around digital media and video games and the ubiquitous access of the image and all the, I mean, all this stuff, right? And it's so, it's too soon to tell.
It's too soon to tell, and you know, and here's my problem with people making judgment calls on a generation is because I don't think any generation can be looked at as a silo in and of itself, right? Like it's not like some separate entity that's out there floating, like millennials are just, you know, they're floating out there by themselves. Like there's a responsibility for us as the people who go before them to actually create like resonance that's in for them to, you know, to grab onto. I mean, there's, you know, and this has come up so much, obviously, in the last couple of years in particular, everything that's around bullying and all the things, there's nothing new under the sun, right? An old, age-old philosopher said that, like, I don't know about you, but, like, I don't know anybody who wasn't bullied at one point in time.
Right.
The difference is now, I think that we've as the people have gone before them, to a certain degree, we have to take responsibility because we've relinquished the privilege that we've had that we have and the opportunity we have to actually create space for that generation coming up behind and to mentor them and to actually take responsibility to help them learn how to structure a world around them that's going to help them become resilient. And if there's anything that I think is maybe lacking, and this is kind of a harsh statement, but I feel like we've not done our job to help create a resilient world for the generation coming up behind, to give them opportunities to build resilience in their own lives.
I love what you said earlier when you were talking about this. I think you were talking about the study and young women. Two things, mentors and volunteer and volunteering.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. I mean, the thread is there clearly. I mean, they're kind of one and the same. The mentors are volunteering, the volunteers are mentoring.
Yeah,
it's really
totally.
Yeah, it's quite lovely.
Yeah, it is. And you know, at no age in our lives do we ever not have a need to have multi-generational relationships, right? Because there's just so much that we can learn at all from all generations before and after us. And so I find myself and feel very privileged to work a lot with millennials and with the upcoming generation. But more than that, I feel very privileged to have such a wide variety of people in my life and resources to draw from and to help, you know, along the way as well. Because I realize now that, you know, part of my story is that I have a lot to offer them at different places too along the journey.
Are you hopeful? I mean, it sure sounds like you are about this crazy world we live in. I mean, you know, you don't have to go too far to find out it's not looking that great.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. In the country that I choose to spend most of my time in, Cambodia, I continue to read some pretty difficult news. You know, pretty much on a daily basis coming out of Cambodia with respect to human rights and labor issues and union issues and political issues. Poverty and so on. A, are you still hopeful and why? in 30 seconds or less, Crystal.
In 30 seconds or less.
Kidding. We got a couple minutes left.
Yeah. But make it good.
That's right. Give me something quotable. Come on.
I am hopeful. And so sure, call me Pollyanna if you want. But I'm hopeful because I feel at the core of who we are to draw on Viktor Frankl a little bit, there's always going to be that search and that quest for meaning. And no search that's ever done in the search of good, I don't think there can be disappointment. I love wins all the time. Love will always win. And it doesn't negate the things that are happening. And it's horrible. And sadly with the rise of all our accessibility to things, I know that it also gives the rise for evil to, and just hurt people will hurt other people. And that's why I think it's just all the more important for us to remember that we decide what we're going to believe, because if we actually are willing to change that belief and to create the future that we want for ourselves, not so much in terms of like, I want to have X number of children and I want to do this and this and this, because those things are largely undetermined. But if we truly are willing to determine who we are going to become, then we do hold a stake in that. And I think we can help to sway that. And I don't think we'll ever completely rid the world of the evils, but we can definitely make a dent in it if we're willing to have the courage to try.
So I don't know if I'm old enough to know that change is possible. How's that for a quote? Because I have a friend who's older than me who thinks that change is just complete nonsense, right? It's, old, can't teach old dog. I mean, he's so bought into this idea that you just can't change. And I think sometimes it's just a way of absolving yourself of personal responsibility. And I would say that directly to his face and laugh at the same time. And I think on some level he would agree. But, our kids are growing up, this generation or in the last 20 years, the whole bottled water, environmental, ecology of commerce, CSR-like attitude or ethos or values that I certainly didn't grow up with. I mean, isn't that a reason to be hopeful? I mean, in a sense that it's becoming a part of the conversation. Because I guess while you were just chatting about that, I mean, I'm with you, man. I'm idealistic. I call my, hopeful cynic. I want to change the world. I think it is changing. But, you've got the reality of the horror out there and what isn't working, in humanity's favor, if you will. And yet you look and you go, well, hang on a second here. My kids are talking about things in a way that I never did. In a social justice, like they're growing up with me to we. They're growing up with this idea of water and sanitation problems on the other side of the world that I never knew existed.
Right.
And I think that's reason to be hopeful. I think that's reason to get excited,
I think so too. And I feel that there is the one gain that we have in our generations and beyond is that there's the ability to formulate strategies around known things now. There's now that we understand why there is for example, a water crisis, then that gives us a framework to work within to be able to think strategically and innovatively around what I can do to make a difference in that. And that may be, that may be to some degree, because we also live in a, such a prolific age of knowledge and, that the coming generations are growing up with that, and it's exciting to think about what's possible, and it's also exciting to think about what's possible for us to nurture in that now in our lifetime as well, because there's a great and awesome and beautiful responsibility that we have to be able to nurture that in ourselves and in those who are coming behind us.
I love the idea of, we've talked about so much today. We really are going to have to do a part two. It's clear it's taken us a heck of a long time to get to this interview, but the idea that love wins is just, I think, a pretty nice way to end. So I'm going to call back to that. Crystal Earle, Your Brilliance, correct me if I get anything wrong here, Crystal, yourbrilliance.unlimited.com. Check out her website there. She's got a book called Resonate about, hang on, let's see if I can get the subtitle, We Can Change the Stories We Tell Ourselves. She's on all over social media. And your blog. Tell us real quick about your blog.
Oh, yeah. On Tuesdays, I have a blog called The Sweet Tuesday Blog.
Nice.
And so there I talk it's mostly based on my own experience and stories that I'm sharing. But every week I share strategies and ways that we can, in particular, find confidence and courage to continue to change our stories. So, and actually on my site, you can let your listeners know, or the people listening today, I have a free video e-course, and it's called Find Your Brave. And they can sign up on my site. And it's just a simple but quick e-course that gives listeners and community member strategies for how they can begin to find their points of courage to make the decisions and change their stories.
Fantastic. I'll put a link in your bio as well online. Crystal, thanks a lot for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.